Regarding this Karma Yoga, the most important point we discussed was karma is a way of progressing towards our goal. And what is our goal? To be immortal, to manifest our divinity. And we live in a world of karma. Karma means action. There is no way we can escape work. Whatever we think, whatever we talk, whatever we do, everything is karma or action, work. And not only what we do, but what others do also has a tremendous effect upon us all. For example, if you are in a place which is full of noise, the neighbors are quarreling, or there is a lot of advertisement going on, what would be its effect upon you? You would be disturbed. You want to meditate, or you want to read, you want to be peaceful. They would not allow you to do it. So we are influencing other people by our actions. And many times, how ignorant we are, how much trouble we give to others, all unconsciously, blissfully unaware that we are the source of the greatest trouble to others. But we are quick to find out how the others are source of great trouble to us. We irritate people so much, even sometimes by our very presence. It is a very peculiar fact of life. We may not be doing consciously anything, but still we manage to irritate other people, just as some people, by their very existence, irritate us. So it works both ways. Suppose another example of how karma affects us. Suppose you were born in Russia. What are your chances of being a religious person, much less a spiritual person, practically nil? There is America, at present, a big controversy is going on. The matter has gone up to the courts. What should be taught to the pupils? Should they teach the Darwinian theory of evolution, or should they teach the biblical idea of evolution? Formerly, those who were fanatical religious, they fought on the ground that these students should not be taught this ridiculous scientific idea of Darwinian evolution, theory of evolution. But then, of course, they were brushed aside. So that devil in them has taken a different form. They don't say any longer it is biblical theory or accepting God, God created. They call it ID, intelligent design. But they mean exactly the same thing. So there is a controversy going on there. It had to be taken to the court. This is one example. Another example is whether prayer should be taught in the schools. And so there are people, we are free, we do not want any prayer, so you should force prayer upon us. But some people, of course, they say, yes, it is good to have a prayer. Many people have accepted that it's good to pray. But the big problem is, what type of prayer? Do you pray to Christ, or do you pray Jehovah, or you pray Rama, or you pray Krishna? So it was squashed, because they couldn't agree to which God they should address the prayer. So all these kinds of stupid controversies are going on. If we are in the midst of those people, we will be affected by them. Suppose you are born in an Orthodox Indian family, there are more chances that you would at least become an Orthodox religious person. I'm not talking about spirituality. You observe certain things because you have been taught to learn from the beginning of your life. So there are also people often who think themselves as intelligent, that a child should not be given or forced, that is the word they use, to about religion, spirituality and other things. What is their argument? See, let the child grow up, let him become intelligent, rational, and then let him decide what he would like to do. How many children are intelligent enough when by the time they grow, their ideas are already fixed? It is not possible. So in India, in the ancient times, Gurukula system used to be very prevalent. Gurukula means what? A student goes from his home and lives with a teacher who is had a reputation for good character. They didn't care for academic type of learning. Any type of learning is sufficient. But what is most important, how to acquire character. And character, if you open your eyes, cannot be acquired from the textbooks. If you see some people who are of character, and then you learn by imitation through them, you get inspiration from them. I have never come across a single person who read some books and became either moral or man of character. Character is like knowledge. And this knowledge can only come from one living person to another living person. Dead books can never ignite the lamp of knowledge within us. Even academically, it is very true. So the point is, whether we like it or not, we are all living in a furious world of action. 24 hours action is going on. And whether we like it or not, we are being influenced by us. Swami Vivekananda even went further and said that we are like broadcasting and receiving stations. You know, we have all radios. Radios can only receive, but cannot often transmit, broadcast. But there are broadcasting stations which both broadcast and also receive. Each one of us are like a broadcasting station. That point we will come. Swami himself raises the topic. So we are attracting forces from all over the world, and we are also repelling people and forces away from us. And we are caught in this whirlpool. So this is called bondage. We are attracting some, we are repelling some. Sometimes we are happy, sometimes we are unhappy. Up and down, up and down. Since how many ages we are going on through this, God alone knows. But we have come to the right stage of evolution when we have acquired, supposedly, self-consciousness. Means the ability to look back upon us as an object and to find out what is this object doing? What is its nature? Is there something we can do to improve upon it? Are there some defects which can be removed? We can examine and we can improve upon the image of ourselves. So now we come to the proper discussion of karma. The word karma, Sanskrit word, means action. And in this, as I said, furious action is going on, but every action has a reaction, and but every reaction doesn't affect everybody who does the work or everything that does the work. In order to qualify something as work, five conditions are to be fulfilled. First of all, what is work? Work is transference and transformation of energy. You want to move one foot, you are transferring energy. Energy is being used from one state to the another state. A small child grows up, energy is being transferred. But energy is also being transformed, not merely transferred. A small seedling, within 3 months, it grows. It is transforming the energy into life force, into proteins, into food materials, building, bodybuilding materials, and it is developing. So the energy is not merely being transferred from the sunlight, from the food materials, from the fertilizers, but it is also being transformed. So any energy that is transformed and transferred is called work. But suppose you are traveling in a car or a fan is going on and the fan is furiously working. The car also is furiously working and the light bulb is giving us light. That is also work because it is also transference of energy. But can you call it? It is the bulb is working, my car is working very hard, my fan is working very hard, so let me give it a little rest, it must be tired, let me fan it a little bit. Would you do that? No. The first condition of karma is only that which is done by a living conscious being is qualified to be called as work. A living being. And not merely a living being, because there are so many times, so many living beings who do the work, but they are not conscious. For example, if a child discharges a gun, you don't punish him. You merely protect him from doing this harm again. But if a person who thinks about it, he schemes about it, who plans about it, and then discharges a gun and kills somebody, then you take action, right? Similarly, you know, accidents. If you are driving, you are careless, and somebody is hurt, then that's one type of punishment. But deliberately, you drive the car over another person, and then another type of punishment. The end result is the same, but the effect upon the doer is completely different. So, not only a living being, but he must also do it consciously. So the work, the transference of energy done by a conscious living being, that is called work. So this living being also, even though he may be doing consciously, for example, Sri Ramakrishna is teaching to his disciples very consciously, but he is not affected by that work. You cannot call Sri Ramakrishna is working. If you ask him, you know, the gospel of Ramakrishna you come across. He had spoken beautifully on God's spirituality. The listeners were charmed, mesmerized. So they said, thank you very much, sir. You have given such beautiful talk. He says, I do not know anything. I just eat and drink. It is my mother who does it. So a second factor is necessary. What is that? The person must feel that I am doing it. This is called doership, kartrutva in Sanskrit. I am the karta, I am the doer. This is the second. Thirdly, there must be a desire. If a person does something without any desire, then the result will not attach. He himself will not call it as work. This is called is motiveless action, unselfish action, or desireless action, or karma yoga, nishkama karma yoga. If Swami Vivekananda had gone and preached Vedanta to the Western world, and if you ask, sir, you are a wonderful person, you did marvelous, he says, I know nothing. I am just an instrument. It is the Divine Mother, it is God, it is Brahman who has done that. Because there is no desire in him for the result. All of us fall under the category of desirers. We do not do anything without a desire. We would not even lift a straw from the ground without any desire. We always think, what benefit can I get? Sri Ramakrishna used to give, you know, in a funny way, a village example. Suppose you ask some person, lazy fellow, is sitting there and you are busy, but you want to buy some jaggery, you know, jaggery, a sweet like thing. in villages that is called sweet. So you go and buy a few pence worth of jaggery and bring it to me. It often comes in lumps. So the fellow, he is very lazy, he is not doing anything. But he doesn't want to do because he is lazy. But he has to do because you have asked him to do. He goes there and on the way he licks it as much as possible. So I am doing this work. Why should I do this work? Let me get some benefit out of it. So all of us, we have got a motive, a desire, an expectation. Only when we do something with some expectation, that is called work. That is, in Sanskrit, there is a word that is called bhoktritva, enjoyership, doership and enjoyership. And we cannot enjoy if we do not have desires. It is impossible to enjoy if we do not have a desire. Have you ever noticed that? It's very interesting. I'll give an example. Suppose you have just eaten food and your stomach is full. You are absolutely, you are not hungry, you have no desire to eat food. Somebody says, well, my wife has prepared very fine sweet meat, why don't you come? You say, of course you say, no, I don't have any appetite, I don't feel like eating. He says, okay, doesn't matter, just one small sweet, you come. You go to his house and then the sweet has become, it has come out really well. You eat one sweet and say, oh, it has come out very well. In Bengali, if you say it has come out very well, means I want a second and third helping. So you get another piece. Now here is the point. You have absolutely no desire. If that man had not invited you, you would not have gone and eaten. You would not have bought it. Even if it is there in your house, you would not have eaten. But you have gone there as though to oblige that person, but you have enjoyed it. Do you think you could have enjoyed it if you had really no desire for it? No. You had a desire, but it was hiding. And this offering of sweet, as soon as you put it in your mouth, that hidden desire has come to the fore. Enjoyment is impossible without desire. So, only a person who has desire, and he works, and he gets the result, he is called the a person who does work, and whatever he does, that deserves to be called work. That is the third factor. Fourth factor is that every person who has desires and who does consciously something and who enjoys, he must take responsibility for what he does. Now it is a very wonderful thing. Suppose in the same example I gave, a child is playing with a loaded gun, accidentally discharges it, and somebody is hurt or killed. The boy, the child, will not feel guilty about it. Have you ever seen? Of course, you see that he doesn't do such thing. And in fact, you blame the parent who did not look after the child and allowed that child to play with a loaded gun. You blame the person, parents, grown-up people. You don't blame the child. The child also doesn't feel anything. Because he has no moral responsibility. First of all, he has no desire. He's just playing, and it was an accident. But we, if we do something, especially something bad, we feel morally responsible. We feel guilty. Even if you say, I am a Nishkama Karma Yogi, doesn't help. We feel very guilty about it. We have to do something about it. So every action that a conscious human being does with expectation of fulfillment of a desire and enjoys it has to take willy-nilly this moral responsibility. And lastly, the fifth, that every action has a cosmic effect. This is what Hindus mean by the law of karma. You do something good, whether you like it or not, it will come back to you in the form of a result. Do something bad, it will come back to you. This law of karma is a most marvelous theory Hindus have ever propounded. Now, regarding this moral effect of this, cosmic effect of this law of karma, see, there are two views. There is the Semitic view and there is the Vedantic view or Hindu view. According to Semitic religions, immorality or wrongdoing means disobedience to God. God told the first man, Adam, do not eat the fruits of this tree, and he deliberately went and ate the fruits of that tree. And ever since, he and his descendants are suffering. This is the beginning of the theory, you know, originator. Every man is a born sinner. You deliberately disobeyed the commandments of God. Therefore, sin attaches itself to you. But the Vedantic point of view is, no, there is a law of karma. It has nothing to do with God. God doesn't care whether you eat fruits or do not eat fruits. Says if you eat fruits, if they are good fruits, then you enjoy. If they are bad fruits, you suffer. I have nothing to do with it. So squarely, the responsibility lies on each one of us, on individuals. And this, I think, is a most marvelous law, because supposing a person doesn't believe in the existence of God, then where is the question of his feeling he is a sinner or he is doing something wrong? Whereas this law of karma is, it doesn't matter whether you believe in God or not. Whatever you do, if you are doing with responsibility, then you will have to, either you suffer or you enjoy. Either you thank yourself or you damn yourself. You are squarely responsible. So these are the five things present in anything that can be legitimately called work. First of all, it should be a living being. Secondly, it should be work or action should be done consciously. Thirdly, the person must feel that I have a desire, I have an expectation, and I enjoy this one. Fourthly, he must have some feel responsibility. I am responsible. There was a man who applied for a job, and the interviewer asked him, are you a responsible person? He said, very responsible person, sir. Previously, I have been working in 10 companies, and wherever I worked, something had gone wrong. And they all said, you are responsible. So one must feel that sense of responsibility, and we all do that. And lastly, every action comes back in the form of result. And this result comes in two forms again. One is the outer result. So, for example, if you do some good to somebody, then the good result will come to you at some point in life, in this life, next life, next life. But besides that, there is an inner transformation which we call samskara. Our heart is developing a kind of impression, strengthening the impression, I must do good, I must do good, I must do good. So it is said, you know, that if a person goes on doing good works, he becomes better and better and better person, because his inner impressions are becoming strengthened. But if a person is doing the opposite, he slides down, becomes worse and worse and worse. So these two effects are there. Every action that we do will come back to us at some point. Only mystery of this is at what time it comes back and in which form it comes back, we do not know. And you see, Hindus have a way of viewing life. When we open our eyes and look at this world, at our neighbors, at our own children, And we see enormous difference between one individual and the other individual. Sometimes these children are born to the same parents almost at the same time, but what different fates await them? And why? What is the explanation? Of course, the scientists will say, we don't believe in God, we only believe in genes. The Vedanta says, it is because each one of us, we came with a bundle of impressions from our past lives. That is what makes us either poor or rich, either intelligent or dull, or happy or unhappy. But at least the behaviorist psychologists, they admit this much, which accords with the Hindu theory of law of karma, that if a child grows up in a happy family, that child is more likely to be a happier person. If a child grows up in an unhappy family, more likely he becomes unhappy. There is, of course, 100% fixedity is not there. There are many other factors. Maybe this person who has grown up in an unhappy family inherited some happy impressions from his past life. He could become, turn out to be a very happy person. In fact, there are stories, you know. One story I will tell you, real story. There was a great soul in the last century, born in 19th century, born in Bengal. He was called Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar. He was such a great soul. He was a great scholar, a great philanthropist. Now, he was born in a very poor family. He had to undergo tremendous difficulties because of his poverty. He didn't have money, or rather his father did not have money to provide him with a kerosene lamp to study his textbooks. So this boy used to go out into the streets, stand under the gas lights in Calcutta and study up till until midnight, and he became a great scholar. When he grew up, naturally he got a wonderful job. But because he had undergone so much of hardship as a result of his parents' poverty, his whole outlook has changed. I must help people who are undergoing poverty. And his door was always open. It is said nobody had ever gone from his home with empty hands. There was a wonderful story. One day he was walking in the street and he saw a boy trying to drop a letter in the post box. And the boy happened to be very poor. So this Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar, the word Ishwara in Sanskrit means God. So Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar became curious. So he went to ask the boy, to whom are you writing a letter? The boy said, I am writing to Ishwara, God. What did you write? He said, I am very poor, God, so give me some money. And what address did you put it? He said, Ishwara and heaven. God and heaven, that was the address he wrote. And immediately Ishwar Chandra Vidyasagar said, your letter has reached the right place. It has reached Ishwara. So he took out some money and immediately gave it to that boy. So that poor boy, you know, had faith that somehow this letter will reach the right place, right person, and he would get a response. And he did get the response. So you see, because this man had grown up under hardship, he should have become very miserly. I will enjoy myself. And I will not give a single penny to anyone. No, the reaction was quite opposite. Of course, some people they would become very miserly, very stingy, and say only we will enjoy it. But usually, the circumstances in our family determine how we react. Another example I will give you. You know, so many terrorists, these bombings that have gone on in London. They are not illiterate people, as we used to think. Some villagers who are not literate, they are brainwashed. These are highly educated people. How come that these people turned out to be so terrorists and taking away life? One simple explanation is the church they are going, not the family, but the church they are going, and the leader, religious leader, who has been brainwashing them with all these negative ideas, they have been influenced by that. My point is, supposing this young man is born and brought up in a very good family where he never hears these terrorist things or bad things, would he have done that? Very unlikely. So circumstances and past impressions, they make a tremendous influence upon us. Anyway, for our discussion purpose, these are the five things must be a living being, must run consciously, must have a desire, must assume moral responsibility, and must accept the inevitability of the result. This, when all these five factors are present, they are called work. Now we will start discussing Swami Vivekananda's first chapter, the first chapter on Karma Yoga by Swami Vivekananda is titled as Karma and its effect upon our character. Before I go into it, I have to remind you of a simple story where in Greek mythology, there is the story of a peculiar character called Sisyphus. Have you heard about his name? Sisyphus was a Greek character. He was the king of Corinth and the son of Aeolus. He was such a cunning trickster that he cheated the gods again and again. That shows gods are not over intelligent. And once even chained up death himself, the gods finally succeeded in dispatching him to Hades, where as a punishment for his wicked deeds, he was made to roll a huge stone up a hill, the stone always escaping him near the top and rolling down. He is supposed to be still there, trying in vain to roll the stone onto the top of the hill. What is the point of this story? Our life is like that Sisyphus. From birth to death, from morning till next morning, we are going on working. It is like the Sisyphus trying to go on rolling the stone. What is the purpose? We are working. We are thinking. We are talking. We are doing things from birth to death, and from death again to next birth. We are going on doing and doing and doing work, work, work. Now, if some madcap, we used to say there was a madcap in India, and he was living behind a factory which used to make these pots, mud pots, thousands of mud pots. So, you know, there are some pots which are not baked properly, so they are thrown out. So, this madcap, he will get up early in the morning, rush to the backyard where these useless pots have been there and go on breaking them to pieces. This he does it until sunset, and often he says, I am tired of doing this. I cannot go on any longer. This is too much for me. He goes on doing that. Now who asked him to do that? And why does he do that? He had taken upon himself. We call him mad because there is no purpose, there is no profit out of that work. There is some profit, either to us or to somebody else, then that can be called properly work. So doing something useless again and again is not called doing work, and most of us do that most of the time. So what is the purpose of our life? Of course, if we evolve a little bit morally, intelligently, then we say there is a purpose to life. And according to Vedanta, what is the purpose? To manifest the potential divinity within each one of us. Last week in our class, I had discussed this point. What is the goal of work? Freedom. What is the goal of work? To be free from work. Why do we work? Because we are bound. Why are we bound? What is it that binds us? Desire. And why are we having desires? Because we are not perfect. Until we become perfect, we have desires. When we have no desires, we will not work. And to be free from this imperfection, which is manifesting the divinity of the, it, which is within each one of us, that is the goal of work. That is the goal of life. Why are we here? Not to enjoy, not to do anything. Not to enjoy, not to suffer. We are here to be free. Free from what? Free from bondage. And where is this bondage? Is it outside? No, it is within us. What is that bondage? It is ignorance. What is ignorance? The ignorance is, even though we are divine, we have forgotten that we are divine. And that is why we are suffering. Bondage is a fact of life. We want to be free from this bondage. That is why we are working. Of course, you may say, no, I want to be happy. No, happiness or unhappiness, these are just teachers. Because what you think happy is a state of mind. We are always in a state of knowledge. If you say, I am happy, that is a state of knowledge. If you say, I am unhappy, that is another state of knowledge. It is a thought in the mind. Everything is a thought in the mind. And if that thought is right thought, right knowledge, then we are good people, happy people. If not, we suffer. So what is the goal of karma? Work, to be free from work. Now it is interesting, you know, you go and work from morning 8 o'clock until evening 7 o'clock. And you come back. And then you, I am so happy. What are you doing? I am relaxing. One man, you know, is one Indian. He was a great fan of Milkha Singh. Milkha Singh was a great runner in those days, you know. So he wanted to, somebody told him when he was walking on a seashore that Milkha Singh is somewhere here, a famous man in those days. So this man, for him, you know, every Sardarji looks the same. So he went on asking, he saw suddenly this Sardarji, a bearded man. He ran to him, are you Milkha Singh? He said, no, I am relaxing. So when we come back from work, we say we are relaxing. So you are very happy. At the end of the month when you get your paycheck, then you are very happy. But supposing you get a paycheck without any work, would you like to go to, how many people would like to go to office and really work? Let me see. You would not go. But there would be some people who would still go. Why? Because they feel life is a terrible boredom. The only way to escape from this boredom is to go to work. There was one of our devotees. I don't mean any of you, so don't mind. I asked him, at what time you go to work? He said, Swami, I go to work at 6 o'clock to my office. He said, 6 o'clock? You don't need to go at 6 o'clock. You are a rich man. You could go at 10 o'clock. He said, Swami, I tell you the secret. Please don't tell anybody. It is to escape my wife. So, some people, if there is no work, they cannot relax because they cannot face themselves. This is what Eric Fromm, the great psychologist, calls workaholism. They have become addicted to work. Why do people drink? Because they want to be relaxed. They want to be free from tensions. Why do some people work? Because they cannot bear life without work. They don't know how to enjoy themselves without work. This is the simple reason. Often we feel that life is nothing but a chain of never-ending work, as futile as Sisyphean labor. Day after day, we work and yet do not seem to reach anywhere. Our heart hungers for everlasting peace, security and happiness, and we work hard for the attainment, but fulfillment always seems to elude us. We work solely with the idea of escaping work to earn leisure. Soon we realize that diversions and recreations are very poor substitutes for true fulfillment. Work itself should have led us to fulfillment, but often it doesn't. Work for something else. Even though we are working so hard, life after life, from morning, from birth to death, always when there is no time, not a single second when we do not work. And yet we do not seem to get what we want. Why? There must be something wrong with the way of our working. First of all, do we know what we are working for? Secondly, do we know how to work? We must know the goal why we are working. Secondly, we must know how to do the work also. These are the two areas where Swamiji's Karma Yoga gives us a glimpse. First point he raises, we do not work for the sake of pleasure, for the sake of enjoyment. No. The goal of work is freedom, and freedom comes with knowledge. Knowledge is the goal of life. This is a marvelous statement. I have given you this illustration many times, but I will repeat it again because it's very important. Everything depends upon our mind. Our mind means our thoughts. Our thoughts means the knowledge that we have. Let me give you an illustration. From Ramana Maharshi, there was a great soul, he used it to say, there was a prince and he had nice dinner and he was lying on a beautiful bed by the side of a beautiful wife, and he fell into a slumber. He started dreaming a nightmarish dream. Suddenly the police came, dragged him from his bed, took him to one of the worst prisons in the country, threw him down a dungeon which is full of mosquitoes and scorpions and all that biting insects and all that dirty and smelling, evil smelling and all that. And he was experiencing living hell. There was another man who was actually put in such a prison. He was in that dungeon. And he also had his very poor supper. He also fell into a slumber and he started dreaming. He was in a palace, in a beautiful bed, and one of the most beautiful women was embracing him. Now, who is the happier person? You know, it is not where we are or how we are, but what type of thoughts we entertain. There are people who are just ordinary people but very happy. There are rich, famous people and they are profoundly unhappy. One example that comes to my mind, have you heard the name Marilyn Monroe? You know, the presidents used to seek her company. She was so famous. She was an idol doll of the whole American nation. Of course, I don't hold American nation in high regard in any case. Ultimately, how did she die? She committed suicide. She was addicted to drugs and other things. In young age, she died. Another example that comes, recent example, you know, the footballer who died a few days back. What did he die of? What did he lack? He was very famous man. He had money. He had beautiful woman in his life. He had what you call, what a normal man desires all the time. He had those things and yet he died at this age of alcohol. Why did it happen? There must be some profound something which is troubling him. So it is not our circumstances. It is our mind which determines how happy or unhappy we are. That is why the best saying in Vedanta, mind is the cause of bondage, mind is the cause of liberation again, freedom again. It is to make this mind full of this knowledge that I am divine. That is the goal of work. But how do we get it? So this is the first point. We are not here for pleasure. Pleasure and pain, these are great teachers. And Swami Vivekananda says, often what you call the pain is the greatest teacher. We learn more lessons from pain than from pleasure. There was a Bengali businessman. He was very rich and he became, you know, aged. And his, meanwhile, his son also grew up as a young man. So he inducted his son into the business and slowly wanted to hand over it. But you know, this young man, as young men are, often foolish, unthinking and frivolous and superficial. So his father wanted to give him a good lesson. So he told him, look here my son, I will teach you all that I know about business and you will be my good successor. And the son was very happy, looking expectantly when the son will retire, father will retire, so he can enjoy everything. So it was, he was running a factory. It was a factory which had first floor and ground floor. So one day the son was working on the first floor and the father was on the ground floor. So the father suddenly called to his son, my son, come, I want you to come down urgently. So the son was started coming down the stairs. He said, no, I want you to come down this second. You jump. But the son said, if I jump, I will break my bones. He said, no, I am here to hold you. Come on. And the son jumped. And at the last moment, the father simply put a small hand, but he did not catch the son. The son fell down and then broke some of his bones. And naturally, he was very angry. Father said, this is what I wanted to teach in business. Don't even trust your father. If you learn that lesson, you have learned all that I have gathered throughout my life and became a successful businessman. So pain, this boy will never forget that lesson in his life. Pain often is a great teacher. You look back and you remember how quickly you learned your lessons because of pain. So pain and pleasure, both are teachers. As one of our Swamis had said so beautifully, pleasure pulls us towards God and pain pushes us towards God. The purpose of both is to manifest the divinity which is within us, to have that knowledge. So life after life, we go on learning our lessons. You see, even when you look back in this life itself, you just see what is the greatest lesson we are trying to learn. Do you know what is the greatest lesson? Detachment. If parents, a young couple, they have just a small baby. How lovely that baby is. How attached. They would give their life to protect that baby. And they are bringing that baby with all their love. And the baby soon grows up, becomes a young man or a young woman, and gets married, and starts living in his or her own house, and they start their own family, and the parents, they sit back. And what is the lesson? The lesson is, even though it is our baby, it has its own independent life. We have to be a little bit away from it. You learn that. If you don't learn that lesson, you will again get married, you will again have babies, and again they will go away from you or kick you out or then make you suffer, and ultimately you learn your lesson. Nobody belongs to me, and I do not belong to anybody. Death is the greatest teacher. Husband loses wife, wife loses husband, parents lose children, children lose their parents, friends lose friends. Everywhere this attachment is being broken, where sometimes very harshly, very painfully, but we cope with life. If you don't cope, then you will have to pay heavy price for that in the form of suffering. we learn our lessons, do everything, love everybody, do the best you can, but be detached, be prepared. That is the meaning of life, to make us learn one lesson, single lesson, detachment. Nobody belongs to us. We do not belong to anyone. But is there nobody to whom we can belong and who belongs to us? Yes, there is only one. And that is our own self, our God, our Divine Mother in the words of Sri Ramakrishna. Nobody else belongs to us. And often we do not learn our lesson. How much pains we undergo in life for bringing up our children and this and that. Many times they turn out to be either ungrateful, downright ungrateful, or at best indifferent, a little bit indifferent. Okay, they move away, they have their own life. Now and then they say, happy birthday, mom or dad. Or if you are old, they will put you in an old age home. What a painful situation it is. But we still learn, do not learn our lessons, detachment. Detachment is not cold-heartedness. It is learned to do everything with whole heart, but do not expect. What is it that binds us? It is not doing that binds us. It is the expectation that binds us. So that is the part of this Karma Yoga. Now we are dealing with Karma Yoga. Karma and Karma Yoga are not the same. Karma means action. Action brings its results. Karma Yoga, it brings only one result. See, in this world, every action has its own specific result. If I thump this table, it has one result. If I flick this switch, it has another result. If I walk upstairs, it has another result. If I smile at you, it has one result. If I frown at you, it has another result. But in the Karma Yoga, you frown, you put on the switch, you thump the table, you go upstairs, you do anything. Every action has only one result. What is that result? The result is self-knowledge. You know who you are. That is because you do not expect specific result. So Karma Yoga is the art of turning every action so that it can yield only one result, and that result is how to purify our mind, how to detach ourselves from this body, mind, from this world, how to know who we really are. That is the only result. So this is the first point Swami Vivekananda makes. The goal of karma or life is not pleasure. Of course, nobody says unhappiness is my goal of life. But there are many people who do not say that, but do it to make other people unhappy is the goal of my life. There are many people like that, quite a number of people. Of course, they don't say that, but they do it. Many people do that. Most of us do that. We do not mean that sometimes, but in the course of life, we are bound to give trouble to ourselves. Any action done with selfishness, it invariably brings trouble to other people. But what we do not understand is, it also brings to us selfishness, may give some trouble to other people for some time, but it gives more trouble to us. Unselfishness brings happiness both for others and also for ourselves, definitely. So the goal of life is how to have knowledge, self-knowledge. Knowledge is, again, it is not something that comes from outside. Knowledge is inherent within ourselves. This is the second point. It's a most marvelous point. We have forgotten. It is Vedanta tells all the time, no, you have a needle because you work many times with the needle. You have kept it somewhere, but you have forgotten it. So you are searching the whole house. You needed the needle, but where is it? And after long, long, long search, then you come to know, oh, the needle is here. Sometimes Vedanta gives the example. There was a man who was practically blind. he can't see without his specs. So suddenly it came to him that he lost his specs. And he went on searching the whole house and he couldn't find. So he started weeping. So the neighbors came running, "Why are you weeping?" He said, "You know, I'm practically blind as a bat. I can't see without my specs. And I have been searching since the last 3 hours." He said, "Foolish fellow, how could you see and search if your specs are not there on you?" You know, he cannot even search if the spectacles are not there on his eyes. But he had forgotten the fact that the specs are there all the time. And he has been searching for the specs. This is one. Sri Ramakrishna used to give another example. There was a man who used to smoke. So one night, midnight, suddenly he felt that he needed to smoke, but he couldn't find any fire. You know, usually in Indian villages, they keep the hurricane lantern at the wick is at a low level. So he put it up bright and went to the neighbor, started knocking at midnight. And after long knocking, the fellow came out and said, What is the matter? "I feel like smoking. Can you give me some fire?" "Stupid fellow, you are holding the fire all the time in your hands. And you are asking for fire here. Why don't you use your hurricane lantern?" This is the analogy this Vedanta gives us. All the knowledge, all the happiness that is within us, all perfection is within us. That is the meaning of potential divinity. We are divine. But we have simply forgotten. All the work that we do is to get this knowledge. And this knowledge doesn't come from outside. This knowledge comes from within ourselves. But even though the knowledge is within ourselves, it needs some friction, some suggestion, some outside help. So, a guru, or worshipping God, studying the scriptures, going on pilgrimage, doing meditation, or doing unselfish actions, all these are like frictions, like suggestions. So that the impurities, the coverings will fall down, and we discover the knowledge. So Vedanta always held the view that we do not invent knowledge. We do not get it from outside. We uncover it. There is a word Vedanta uses, Rishi. Rishi means discoverer of truth. So the truth is not outside. The truth is within us. Any type of knowledge, secular or spiritual, everything is within us. So our actions, either they cover our knowledge or they uncover the knowledge within us. So that type of action which uncovers the knowledge within us is called right type of action. That brings happiness, that brings knowledge, that brings us nearer to perfection. And that is why we are living this life, to uncover the knowledge that we are divine. We will discuss these topics in our next class. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.